First reading is from the book of Exodus, and it's Exodus chapter 20, and beginning at verse 1, and that's on page 77 in the church Bibles. And God spoke all these words: I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commands. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honour your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor.
The next reading is from Isaiah 44, from verse 6 to 20, and that's found on page 729 of the Church Bibles. This is what the Lord says: Israel's King and Redeemer, the Lord Almighty, I am the first and I am the last. Apart from me, there is no God. Who then is like me? Let him proclaim it. Let him declare and lay out before me what has happened since I established my ancient people and what is yet to come. Yes, let him foretell what will come. Do not tremble, do not be afraid. Did I not proclaim this and foretell it long ago? You are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? No, there is no other rock. I know not one. All who make idols are nothing, and the things they treasure are worthless. Those who would speak up for them are blind. They are ignorant to their own shame. Who shapes a god and casts an idol which can profit him nothing? He and his kind will be put to shame. Craftsmen are nothing but men. Let them all come together and take their stand. They will be brought down to terror and infamy. The blacksmith takes a tool and works with it in the coals. He shapes an idol with hammers. He forges it with the might of his arm. He gets hungry and loses his strength. He drinks no water and grows faint. The carpenter measures with a line and makes an outline with a marker. He roughs it out with chisels and marks it with compasses. He shapes it in the form of man in all his glory, that it may dwell in a shrine. He cut down cedars, or perhaps took a cypress or oak. He let it grow among the trees of the forest, or planted a pine, and the rain made it grow. It is man's fuel for burning. Some of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. But he also fashions a god and worships it. He makes an idol and bows down to it. Half of the wood he burns in the fire. Over it he prepares his meal. He roasts his meat and eats his fill. He also warms himself and says, "Ah, I am warm, I see the fire." From the rest he makes a god, his idol. He bows down to it and worships. He prays to it and says, "Save me, you are my God." They know nothing. They understand nothing. Their eyes are plastered over so that they cannot see, and their minds closed so that they cannot understand. No one stops to think. No one has the knowledge or understanding to say, "Half of it I used for fuel. I even baked bread over its coals. I roasted meat and I ate. Shall I make a detestable thing from what is left? Shall I bow down to a block of wood?" He feeds on ashes. A deluded heart misleads him. He cannot save himself or say, "Is not this thing in my right hand a lie?"
Well, good evening, everyone. It's great to see you here at City Church this Sunday evening. As you know from John's words of introduction, from his prayer, we're looking together at these Ten Commandments, starting, you wouldn't be surprised, with week one, commandment number one, who comes first. And what we want to see as we look at this series of the Ten Commandments is that the Ten Commandments are really God's words of life for his people. We've called it God's design for life. That's where we discover and know how to live as God's people, as his word is set out before you. And last week we started with a general introduction, so if you haven't caught that, you might want to listen in again on the web, on the City website, and follow that down. I'll try and give you the briefest of recaps if you weren't here last week. We began by asking the question, what is the point of the Ten Commandments? Charles Saatchi is an advertising guru. You might know his wife, Nigella Lawson. And Charles Saatchi has written a new book in the last month, and it's called Be the Worst You Can Be, Life's Too Long for Patience and Virtue. Perhaps with a title like that, it's a little unsurprising that Charles Saatchi has something to say about the Ten Commandments, and he describes them, I quote, as an overrated lifestyle guide. Well, many more would not just call the Ten Commandments an overrated lifestyle guide, but simply an outdated rule book for people who maybe still hold on to a little bit of religion. But what we saw last week as we started to look at the Ten Commandments is its place in the book of Exodus. And its place tells an altogether different story. Do have your Bible open at those verses that we had read, and turn back with me to page 77, would you? And Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, which really introduce everything that will follow. Page 77, chapter 20, God spoke all these words. "I am the Lord, your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." Exodus is the gospel told in the Old Testament. It's the message of a God who rescues his people, saves them from something, but who saves them for something. And we thought a little bit last week about how easy it is to focus all of our attention on what God has saved us from, and as Christians, give very little thought as to what God has saved us for. Well, if Exodus 1 to 19 are the story of what God has saved us from slavery and the tyranny of a master over us, Pharaoh in the Old Testament, the slavery of sin and death as fulfilled in the New Testament, then Exodus 19 and following is going to teach us what we've been saved for, that the God of rescue is also the God of relationship. As Hugh was saying just this morning, the God who has saved us from hell has saved us, not just for heaven, but saved us for himself. The God of rescue is the God of relationship. And so at Mount Sinai, God is entering into his covenant. It's a bit like attending a marriage ceremony, a marriage covenant, in which God is saying, "I will be your God, the God who has rescued you. I'll enter into a relationship with you. I will be your God, and you will be my people, and together we'll show the world how great it is to live in relationship with the God who has made you for himself." That's the purpose of the relationship, to declare to the nations the greatness of God. So the Ten Commandments are therefore our response of love to a God who has loved us first. And that's why Jesus, when he summarizes the whole of the law, says, well, it's easy. The law can be summarized in two commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And so we learn that God is saying three things to us through the Ten Commandments. He's saying, firstly, this is who I am. I'm the Lord your God. And the Ten Commandments show us who God is, what matters to him, what's of importance for him. And secondly, it shows us this is what my people will look like, what God's design is for our lives as his saved and rescued people. The film director Cecil B. DeMille, who made the movie of the Ten Commandments, some of us might be old enough to remember it, he said this in a speech, not about the film, but about a reflection on the book of Exodus and the commandments. He says this, he says, God does not contradict himself. He didn't create man and then as an afterthought impose upon him a set of arbitrary, irritating, restrictive rules. He made man free and then gave him the commandments to keep him free. Do you see? He made man free. That's Exodus 1-18. He rescued, liberated God's people. He made man free and then gave him the commandments to preserve, to protect, to enrich that relationship with God who made us for himself. He gave them the commandments to keep them free. So God's design in the Ten Commandments is to teach us about himself and then to show us how we are to live as his people. It's really the life that God's people have always been called upon to live. It's exactly the same life that Adam and Eve were called upon to live. It's exactly the same life described in the Ten Commandments that Jesus lived. In fact, if you want to know how to fulfill the Ten Commandments, you look at Jesus, who's the embodiment of the commandments for us. The commandments are God's design for life. From the beginning of the Bible in Adam and Eve to the fulfillment of all things and the new creation, where we will live the Ten Commandments perfectly. We also saw, of course, that in the Ten Commandments, we discover this is why God says, I am sending my Son. Because the Ten Commandments, as we read them and as week by week we understand them, we realize they show us how much we need a Savior. Because we fail to keep the Ten Commandments. Just as Adam and Eve failed to go God's way, and just as we read through the book of Exodus and the whole story of the Old Testament is of Israel repeatedly failing to love the Lord their God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, so we fail them too. So please, if you're here looking into Christianity tonight, don't think that what we're about is keeping rules to earn a relationship with God. What we see is that as God's people, we can't live God's way. And we're as dependent upon Jesus today as much as we ever were. If God can forgive our sin and give us new life for him. Jesus kept the Ten Commandments for us. And it's Jesus' Spirit within us now that begins to write these commandments on our hearts. That's the promise of the new covenant. Matt Chandler has said this. He said, the commandments address what the gospel restores. I think it's a beautiful summary of what we're all about over these weeks. The commandments address what the gospel restores. The commandment says, love the Lord your God with everything that you have. And we know we can't. And then in the gospel, God begins to enable that obedience by his Spirit. So the Ten Commandments become the Ten Promises. God is going to fulfill every one of them in our lives at the end of all things. And that's why as Christians, if we're here this evening, we want to look deeply into these commands because we want to see how God is going to write them into our hearts and transform our lives so that one day, yes, we will be his people as we were always intended to be. So tonight, first commandment, verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. So I want to start tonight by asking, why this first commandment? Maybe we could start asking it this way. Isn't the first commandment, well, just a bit irrelevant? Maybe it's irrelevant to you because you're not a Christian and you're just not religious. So you wouldn't even relate to this idea of having any other gods. You just don't have any gods. Or maybe you're here this evening as a Christian. You say, well, I only worship one God. So should we just skip on from this one and move on to the second commandment and tick the box and we've done that? Well, no, I don't think it's as easy as that. Certainly at the time at which God gives the commandments to Israel, there were plenty of other gods, plenty of other deities. And we read, didn't we, in the book of Isaiah, of idolatry, of people crafting and making gods in their images. Flick through the Bible and you'll hear some of their names. They're worshipped by the name of Baal or Asherah. They're worshipped by the names of Moab or Dagon, Zeus or Wotan, Thor or Artemis. Names in the Bible, names from Greek and Roman mythology, but in our sophisticated secular culture, we could think that the first commandment could be quickly passed on, couldn't it? After all, not many people worship anymore, do they? Well, okay, true enough. You won't find many statues. You won't find many shrines in houses in the Western world. We're not making idols quite like the craftsmen of Isaiah chapter 44. But I want to say that idolatry is not absent. It's just a whole lot more sophisticated. C.S. Tang is a minister in Singapore, and he said this. He said, we were not created to worship. We were created worshippers. There's a difference. I'll try and explain it in a moment. A friend of mine said to me yesterday, he said, everyone has the capacity to run a marathon. Do you believe that? I'm not sure I do. He says, I'm convinced. He said to me, I'm convinced everyone can run a marathon. What he's saying is not that everyone has run a marathon, not that everyone will run a marathon, but if everyone wanted to and could put in the training, they could do it. And I guess sometimes we think, well, we're all created to worship, but some of us don't. We've all got the capacity to relate to God, but some of us are not doing it. C.S. Tang says, no, that's not what's going on in the world. It's not that some of us are worshiping and some of us merely have the ability but choose not to. He says, no, it's not that we were merely created to worship. It's that we were created worshippers. In other words, we can't help ourselves but worship. Matt Chandler says, we are never not worshipping. Every aspect of every part of our lives, we are choosing to worship. Jim Packer tries to help us understand what that means when he says, your God is what you love. It's the thing that has first place in your heart, perhaps. Packer says, your God is what you love. It's what you seek. It's what you worship. It's what you serve. It's this. It's what you allow to control you. It's what makes the decisions in life. Maybe it's a job. Maybe it's just the hope of a career. Maybe it's a relationship. Maybe it's what your parents think of you. It's what calls the shots and has first place in your heart and in your life. So idolatry is as present today because we can't help but give ourselves to other things. Would you turn to just one cross-reference, Colossians chapter 3, so keep a thumb in Exodus, and we'll see that it's here. It's not just something we say now that perhaps people aren't bowing down and worshipping statues, but even in the Bible it talks about this more kind of sophisticated, deeper set idolatry. Colossians chapter 3, page 1184. We haven't got time to study it, but I just want to read it to show you that it's there. Verse 5 of chapter 3. Paul says to Christians, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is what? You see that? He says greed is idolatry. And Jesus says exactly the same thing, doesn't he, in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you cannot serve two masters. So who are you going to worship, Jesus is saying? What are the two options he puts before you? He doesn't say God or Dagon, God or Moab. He says God or money. So even in the New Testament, you find Jesus saying, there's a whole lot more going on in our lives than at first we might realize. It's not that we were merely created to worship. We can't stop worshiping. So the question is not whether we worship. The question is what we worship. Every moment of every day, we're giving our heart to something. In our relationships, in our use of the internet, in the way we play sports, when we sit down to do an exam, when we're interviewed for promotion at work, whatever it might be, we are worshipping beings. Because the question is, what is the first priority in my heart as I enter into this room, as that thought comes into my mind? Okay, that's what's going on. That's why it isn't irrelevant. Because there are all sorts of things that we give ourselves to. And most idolatry, to use Matt Chandler's phrase, is to make a good thing a God thing. It's to take something that's inherently good in of itself, like money, or relationships, or sex, to take a good thing and to make it a God thing in our lives, to make it the thing that I must have, the one thing that I can't live without. And that's why it's so difficult to spot. You know, Jesus is saying money's not bad, but when a good thing becomes a God thing, when it's a God substitute, when it's the thing that has the first affection and place in your heart, that's when it becomes worship. And that's when it becomes idolatry. And that's when God is concerned. Because God is saying, you shall have no other God before me. Tim Keller says, an idol is whatever you look at and say in your heart of hearts, if I have that, then I'll feel my life has meaning. Then I know I'll have value. Then I'll feel significant and secure. Keller goes on, there are many ways to describe that kind of relationship to something, but perhaps the best one is worship. That's what you're saying. I need it. I must have it. Only if I have it am I complete. And that means that everyone worships. The only choice we get is what we worship. So the list is endless. It could be football, it could be technology, it could be relationship, family, work, you get the idea. So the first commandment is not irrelevant. And can I say the first commandment isn't intolerance? Now you might be here, someone saying, well look, I'm interested in Christianity, I respect Christians, but an issue I have, a problem I have, is the intolerance of Christianity. To say that their God is the only God. Well, the first commandment certainly does teach us, doesn't it? You shall have no other gods before me. It teaches me that as far as God is concerned in the Bible, as far as God is concerned, there is no one like him. That's the statement he's making. That's what we read in Isaiah chapter 44, wasn't it? There is no one like him. That's the claim. One of the things that I'm constantly having to teach my children to do is to share. So many problems in our house come down to an unwillingness, between the parents as well, by the way, so many problems in our house come down to an inability, an unwillingness to share the car keys, you name it, whatever it might be. But of course, we don't share everything in life. You can't share the steering wheel of a car. That would be massively dangerous. You can't share your marriage bed with someone outside of the marriage without shattering that marriage. There are some things that can't be shared, and God cannot share his glory with another because there is no other God. You see, you shall have no other gods before me is not because God has a crisis of identity, not because he's fundamentally insecure, but the commandment flows out of reality. It couldn't be any other way. God couldn't have given any other command. If there is only one God, then to create any other God to worship is to delude yourself. That language of delusion was there in Isaiah 44, wasn't it? It's madness, it's crazy. Isaiah 44, verse 6, I am the first and last. Apart from me, there is no God. Who then is like me? And if the answer to that is no one, then life must begin with love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. It has to be, doesn't it, if there's no one else? So when God says, I refuse to share my worship with anyone or anything else, he's talking perfect sense. It's not an issue of intolerance, it's just an issue of reality. There is no God to share it with. It'd be like telling an only child to share his sweets with his brother. It just makes no sense. He has no brother to share it with. God has no one to share his glory with. It's not intolerant to insist on undivided loyalty if there is only one God. My wife insists on my undivided loyalty because she is my one wife. God insists on my undivided loyalty because he's the only one God. All other gods are fake. It's not that God just happened to be the God who came along at the right time to rescue Israel from Pharaoh and Egypt. It's because he alone was able to do so. It's not just that the God we worship is convenient for us because we were born in Britain or wherever else we were born, or because our parents were Christians, or because someone told us about Jesus. It's because there is no God who has ever defeated death apart from the God of the Bible. I know of no other claim for a God who has actually raised someone to resurrection life from the dead. No other claim. If you know anything different, please do tell me afterwards. But I've not met a single one who's claimed that. There is no other God. The God of the living and the dead. The God who offers eternal life. It's not that God is intolerant. It's just that he's God. So that's why the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me, because they don't exist. In fact, Exodus 20 verse 3 says, you shall have no other gods before me. That little phrase, before me, means to my face. You shall have no other gods to my face. You know when someone gets in your face? You know, that's kind of provocative, isn't it? It's dangerous, it's insulting, it's offensive. God says it's offensive to me when you push another God in my face. And so I'm going to worship this God today. So it's because of the nature of reality that God commands our loyalty. It's as simple as that. One creator, one redeemer, one God. He has a right to rule over us. And what that means is, and maybe you've never thought about this before as a Christian, if you are here as a Christian this evening, is that all that we have and all that we are and all that we possess, if there is only one God, has been given to us by him, through him, and for him. Every part of your life is for God because it's been given you by the one God. So can I ask you whether you believe that this evening? Do you understand it? Do you believe it? And if you do believe it, the question is, well, are you willing to give all that you are to the one God who has given you everything? That's why Jesus says the greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, because there is no other response that a truly rational human being would ever make or could ever make. And it's only sin that stops us making that response. But what does the first commandment teach us about life? Well, it teaches us that this call to love God and to serve no other God is the greatest blessing in life. The reason is, look, you will become like that which you worship. It's written all the way through the Bible, you become like that which you worship. And God says, if you worship me with everything that you are, you will be transformed into my likeness. That's the promise of the Bible for Christians. Our gods will define us and shape us. And so as we look to them, we become more like them. So it's good in life. Because I say, well, Jesus loved God that way, and I want to be like Jesus. Back to the director of the film, The Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille. In 1957, he gave this another extract from that same speech. He said, if man will not be ruled by God, he will certainly be ruled by tyrants, because we'll give ourselves to worshipping fake gods. And he said, there is no tyranny more imperious or more devastating than man's own selfishness. In other words, he knew the harm that would come to us if we refused to worship God and to chase idols instead. He went as far as to say this. He said, we cannot break the Ten Commandments. We can only break ourselves against them. We are the ones who are damaged when we don't live God's way. David Foster Wallace, you can Google Wikipedia, find out more about him. He's one of the great thinkers in the second half of the 20th century, and he once wrote this. He said, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Remember, he's an atheist. No such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships, he says. The only choice we get is what to worship, and an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel that you have enough. It's the truth, he says. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. And so on, he concludes. Do you notice that little phrase? It will eat you alive. God is jealous for your affection and your attention, and he wants you to worship him alone because that is the thing that sets you free. That is where life is found. Everything else will eat you alive. Worshipping God is the only way to be human. Because idolatry is to ask something other than God, good looks and beauty or power, privilege, money. It's to ask something else to be God for you, and it can't bear the weight. It can't deliver the goods because it's not God. It can't give you, as a God substitute, the thing that only God can give you. My search engine sometimes says to me, sorry, but you're looking for something that isn't here. Yes. And that's what we do every time we turn to an idol. Sorry, you're looking for something that isn't here. NME's review of REM's album New Adventures in Hi-Fi was remarkable and memorable. This is what the reviewer said of the album. What if all your dreams come true? If you're Michael Stipe, the answer is disillusionment. Of all the maladies that can strike you down, disillusionment is the darkest. Disillusionment is neither trust betrayed nor hope shattered. Disillusionment is far worse. It is all of your goals attained, all of your ambitions achieved, all your hopes fulfilled, and yet there is no satisfaction, no peace. Disillusionment is the hollow realization that the fault resides within yourself, that even with everything you've ever wanted, you are an incurable emotional vacuum. The review ends like this. Most of us will never get to be where Michael Stipe is, will never find our dreams fulfilled, only to discover that it means nothing. That's the problem. We chase the idols in the vain hope that they'll deliver. And it's only perhaps those who've been lucky enough to see how those idols have let them down that they realize they mean nothing. Isaiah was right when he said, who shapes a god and casts an idol which can profit him nothing? He and his kind will be put to shame. Everybody worship. The only choice to get we get is what we worship. Worship the Lord and find life. Worship the idols of self. They will lead you to death. So what are your idols? Well, Philip Ryken, who's a theologian and author, he says there are two tests that you could spot the idols that you are most vulnerable to. He says they're what we love and what we trust. And they'll be slightly different for different people in this room. What we love and what we trust. So if you want to dig deep in saying, I want to root out these idols so that I can only worship and love and serve the one living God, then ask yourself, what is it that I trust more than God? What is it that I need God to give me. And if he doesn't, then I won't be at peace. Or put it another way, what are you unable to trust God with? I guess for some of us, it might be romantic love. It might be, God, I'm willing to accept anything from your hand as long as one day you provide a spouse for me. I'll make any sacrifice, but that's the one thing you must give me. Give me a spouse. For some of us, it might be financial wealth. For some of us, it might be status and position. It might be a career because we're on a certain degree course that means, yeah, I want to reach the level of consultants. I want to be a partner in the firm. Whatever it might be, what is it that you have to think that life has been worth living? Do you trust God enough with whatever your life gives you? Or there are idols of trust there? Of course, it's also the things that we love. The things that we wake up in the morning and dream about or think about or fantasize about. The things that we hold dear in our hearts. Well, those are your idols. What does it mean for you to keep the first commandment? Well, if it's to have no other God, which means the flip side, stated positively, it's love the Lord your God with all that you are, then Jim Packer says, responding to God's love demands total concentration of purpose. So that in everything you are, there is just one thing that you're aiming at, pleasing and glorifying the Lord. Everything you are, there's just one thing. Everything you do, just one thing you're aiming at, pleasing and glorifying the Lord. And at City, we want to help you work that out and work that in different spheres of life. That's why we have Student Plus after the evening service if you're a student. Because we realize there are student-y issues that we want to help you dig deeper in. That's why we started New Street, our 20s ministry, to help people transition through their 20s and face the new battles, the new idols, the new temptations. That's why we've got men's groups and women's groups, mum's groups and dad's groups. That's why we've got marriage prep and marriage enrichment and parenting courses and other things, because we want to try to help you to have what Jim Packer describes as a total concentration of purpose. That whatever you're doing, whatever sphere of life you're in, you're saying, I have one purpose, pleasing and glorifying the Lord. If there are areas of your life which you think are being untouched by the gospel, come and talk to one of the leadership team. Say, could you help us? I'd love to know what a Christian view of ambition is. Or I'd love to know what a Christian view is of the economy, or a Christian view of the environment, or whatever it might be. Come and ask, find out, so you can have a total concentration of purpose. As you put the bins out, as you go to the gym, as you drive your car, as you choose where to go on holiday, whatever it might be. That's what it means to keep the first commandment, a total concentration of purpose. Finally, very briefly, how is it possible to keep the first commandment? Well, firstly, we remember that Jesus kept it for us. Where we have failed, God's grace has prevailed. He's the only one who has ever loved God with a total commitment of purpose. So we look to him. Say, what would it mean for me to love God? Look at Jesus. Learn from Jesus. Meditate on Jesus. And realize the need of a love for God that is bigger than the love of the things of this world. You've got to feed that relationship with your Lord, haven't you? You've got to invest time in God's word and God's purposes. You've got to seek out good people to spend time with. Who's going to encourage me as a Christian? I need to read good books. I need to perhaps even listen to a sermon in the week just to sort of top me up on the web and keep me going. It's what Thomas Chalmers calls the power of an expulsive love. He says the only way you can deal with a love in your heart is by a more powerful love coming and replacing it. You can't just dig it out and get rid of it on its own. Remember when you were a kid and you had a craze and something was everything to you and you were just totally into the Smurfs or into roller skating, I don't know what it was for you, or Barbie, and you were totally into something and then something else captured your heart. It was the new thing, the new craze. And all of those toys, all of those posters, whatever it might be, they all came off the wall, they were all went up into the attic, and that was that, forgotten, yeah? What changed? A new love. came and kicked the old one into touch. And Chalmers says, if you want to keep this first commandment, it needs to be through a greater love for Christ than for anything in this world. And of course, finally, it's only the Spirit that can do that in you.